Me and Gus. Well, the night of the dance come round, and I'd put in all the day polishing up my gig harness with stove black and getting prepared. I arrived at Ethel's at about 7 o'clock and had to tie up my horse and wait half an hour before she was ready. Then she come out into the kitchen with her coat on her arm and turned round in front of me a couple of times and said, how do I look? Well, I said she looked fine, only I didn't think pink suited her as well as the black velvet she'd worn at the last dance. And at that, her smile seemed to fade a bit, and she seemed to get a little cold and icy. Oh, I suppose you pose as a connoisseur on ladies' dresses, she said. Something seemed to have annoyed her, because as I reached for the coat to help her, she flinched away as if I was wet paint. It was the same climbing into the gig. She nearly had an accident dodging my helping hand. Well, I'd forgotten to bring a blanket for a rug, and just as Ethel was saying that a gentleman would see he had everything before taking a girl out, one of the gig lamps went out, and I had to put the horse in and ask Ethel to hold the reins while I lit it. Then the other lamp went out. Then they both went out at once in a narrow cutting, and Ethel spotted a motor about 5 miles away and got nervy. Altogether, it wasn't a very pleasant drive. If Ethel always acted like that, well, I couldn't see why Gus was so anxious to take her out. Anyway, I took her to the door, and as soon as I'd bought and handed in the tickets, I went along to the men's dressing room to remove the smuts on my hands and face I got while trying to fix the gig lamps. I tore inside then to discover that the first dance was on, and Ethel was dancing with a tall stranger. Gus also had arrived and was standing there grinning at me. Oh, so you didn't bring her after all, he said. Oh, don't talk rot. I didn't come here to dance every dance with a girl, I said. Anyway, after the waltz was over, I went to book at Ethel for the next one. She was sitting with about 20 other girls and didn't notice me till I'd asked her twice. Then she just sort of glanced at me and said, not tonight, Mr. Well, what do you know? If a girl has such a rotten memory as that, she just shouldn't go to dances. That's my opinion. Gus tried his luck after me, and I stood at the door and watched. Ethel seemed to greet him effusively, and then I noticed the back of his neck getting red, and all the girls doing a snigger. Then old Gus made a break for the door, and after he'd swallowed a few times, he told me all about it. She said she'd love to dance with me, only her mother made her promise to dance with nice boys only. What do you know? Well, we both stuck outside till supper time, peeping inside when we thought no one would see us. She's having every other dance with that soft-looking tall guy, said Gus, and we both agreed it was a good job. It saved us the trouble. At supper time, we got a seat behind a door, and everybody going round with the plates missed us. The only part of the hall we could see was the opposite corner where Ethel and the tall guy were sitting, having a great old time. And we had to try to pretend we couldn't see him. But I knew old Gus was getting more touchy every second, and finally he jumped up and said, "Puh!" He jumped up, too, just in time to cannon into a tray full of tea coming through the door. So I let him get ahead, because after that I didn't want people to think we were acquainted. And after a while, I drifted casually out and helped to sponge him down with a bundle of colored tissue paper we'd found in the porch. When he came back into the hall, we saw that the paper had rubbed off on his suit, and he looked as though he'd been rolled through a kapok factory. Well, he went home. I wanted to go home, too, but I had to wait for Ethel. And just before the last dance, Ethel beckoned to me. When I went over to see what she wanted, she gave me a playful lecture for not asking her to dance all evening, but she said she'd forgive me if I asked her for the last dance. So, while we danced, she expressed concern for Gus. She's hardly seen him, she said, and she did hope he wasn't sick. Well, 'twas teeming when we left the hall, absolutely teeming down. She took shelter under a hedge while I went for old Bloss, and I let old Bloss go in a small 2-acre paddock. The night was now as black as sin, and the grass was a foot high. So I goes in, calling, "Coop, coop, good old Bloss, come on, old back, goop, coop, coop," and I tried to make a noise like a bag of chaff. Other people had tied their horses to fences, and they all left by the time I located old Bloss. I heard the crunch, crunch of the horse grazing. The next thing I knew, I'd walked slap bang into her hindquarters, and a hoof whizzed past my ear. So I got my box of matches out and tried striking matches. That didn't do any good. The wind blew them out, and the rain wet the box anyway. I could hear old Blast trotting around me in rings, snorting like a young blood stallion. There seemed to be other horses in the paddock, too. It was more like a stampede of wild mustangs than a respectable milk cart horse. Anyway, I waited until all the snorting and trotting had ceased. And then I tried again. This time my luck was in. My fingers touched a wet flank. So I slipped the rope over her neck, then shouted for Ethel because I didn't even know where the gig was, as I hadn't lit the lamps. "Oh, I'm here," shivered Ethel. "I'm absolutely drenched to the skin." So I felt my way back to the gig, leading the horse, and finding the winkers, I commenced to harness up. Well, you know, I tried that set of winkers a dozen times. But you think I could get it over the horse's ears? Oh, no. Finally, I got out the matches to get one to strike, and its light showed me a big, hairy old draft horse with roomy eyes and a huge head. The old horse sort of looked at me with a pained expression, so I let him go and started to explain to Ethel. I found out afterwards that a contractor had let his team of four horses loose in the paddock for the night. And you know I caught all those horses two or three times each time that night. I got to recognize them by the things they did to me. Finally, in despair, I got one of the gig lamps. I lit it with a dry match I found in my vest pocket and requisitioned Ethel to hold it and flash its light after me as I crept about in the rain and the darkness. And in the end, we caught all bluff. Ethel held the lamp while I harnessed up. She wanted to know why I hadn't thought of lighting the lamp as soon as I'd started. Why I hadn't tied my horse up instead of letting it go. Why I'd brought her to the dance at all. Well, I helped her into the gig in silence, so sometimes when talking doesn't seem of much use anyway, and this was one of them. And her boots went squelch as she stepped up on the step, and then she discovered that I'd forgotten to put the rug and the cushion under the seat out of the rain. I couldn't see why she was so fussy about it. Sitting on a wet seat wasn't going to make me any wetter, and if she was as wet as she said she was, well, it wasn't going to hurt her either. Driving home, I tried to be as cheerful and amusing as I could for a start, but it all fell pretty flat, so I shut up. And I thought a bit. Oh, well, poor girl, I thought. She must be half dead with fatigue. I'll rattle along and get her home out of it. So I hammered old Bloss along in silence and at last arrived at her front gate. Then Ethel woke up out of a kind of trance and thanked me for a most pleasant and enjoyable time. While I was shaking the horse along, trying to get her home out of the rain, she must have been preparing her little farewell speech. She said that, not content with keeping her crouched under a wet hedge for 2 hours, I'd finally forced her out into the rain to catch the horse herself. "Oh, come on, steady on, old lady," said I. "I didn't force you to help." "You did help, certainly, and it was lucky for us you did, or we'd have been there yet, but I didn't force you." "Very well," said Ethel coldly, "then call me a liar. It's quite in keeping with the rest of your conduct all the evening, and I'm only a poor girl and can't resent it." And she sniffed, so I shut up, and then she continued bravely. "And even after the horse was harnessed up, you still showed your temper. Instead of talking and keeping my mind off the miserable state we were in, you got out your whip, lapsed into a sulky silence, and thrashed the poor helpless horse all the way home. And that just shows you. I thought I was getting her home out of the rain. I tried to tell her I hadn't talked because I thought she was too tired to listen, but it only made things worse. Finally, she had all her belongings sorted out, and after telling me to please never to speak to her again, she bounced off inside and I drove off home. I'm getting a bit sick, you know, of being spoken to like that by girls. Gus and I compared notes the next day, and we both decided to give Ethel a big miss the next time he met her anywhere. "It'll be a bit of a jar to her," said Gus, "but it serves her right." Gus seemed to think that if we kept away from her, it would hurt her feelings. But I don't know, I'm not so sure about that myself. Gus, you know, he never heard her really open out like I did that night.
Me and Gus was written by Frank S. Anthony and adapted for radio by Francis Jackson.